Welcome back, everyone, to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo and Joe Resinello.
Oh, you're exactly right, Joe.
We work for the man upstairs, as you do.
You're setting me up quite well. You just gave me an alley-oop.
The greatest revolutionary act you can commit right now is to open your mouth and speak the truth.
Whether you're an academic or you're a regular guy, we have to be fearless.
And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go into the breach. Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, as always, joined by Joe Resinello. And once more, dear brothers and sisters, let us go in to the breach on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. Today, we're very pleased and honored to be joined by friends of the program, Dawn Brohorn and Michael Graney. And Joe, Catholics should be discussing economics. We've had Dawn and Michael on before, and if you're not talking about economics, I think these are important conversations to have, because I think there's a misconception, particularly when it comes to Catholics and Catholic teaching, on how an economy ought to work. And Dawn and Michael are here, and they're going to break down a few things for us, but specifically, we're going to be talking about the Economic Democracy Act, okay? Joe, I can hear them out there right now. Oh, you guys are a bunch of socialists. Far from it, okay? Far from it. But and that's why Dawn and Michael are here, to talk about the Economic Democracy Act and what it is exactly. Michael Graney is a board member and director of research for the Center for Economic and Social Justice in Arlington, Virginia. He's published articles and books on many subjects, including Catholic social teaching, banking and monetary history, and economic personalism. He's a graduate of the University of Notre Dame. Dawn Brohorn is a co-founder, board member, and director of communications of CESJ. She has edited books, written articles, organized forums on the natural law-based Just Third Way, economic democratization, and justice-based management. Dawn serves as project director and a senior instructor for CESJ's Global Online Justice University. She is a graduate of Georgetown University. Michael and Dawn, welcome back to the front line with Joe and Joe, our friends.
Great to be back.
That's good awesome. To be here.
Joe Resinello.
Let's just start with the prayer. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. Remember, O most gracious Virgin Mary, never was it known that anyone who sought your help or sought your intercession was left unaided. Inspired by this confidence, we fly unto you, a virgin of virgins, our mother. To you we come, for you we stand, sinful and sorrowful. O mother of the word incarnate, despise not our petitions, but in your clemency hear and answer us, amen.
Amen.
In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Spirit, amen. As Joe P. said, Dawn and Michael are friends of this show. We love them. Now, why? Because they're fighting for the little guy. That's what Jesus did. And to Joe's point, people hear Economic Democracy Act, they start thinking, you're a communist, you're a socialist. No, we love people. Christ said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And that's what they're trying to do. And their ideas are starting to get traction. They're starting to get invited to talk to some serious people, not only in our country, but internationally. We want to explore that. Let's start off, I think, with first principles. What is the Economic Democracy Act, Dawn? I think that lays the groundwork. Michael, please, you know, jump in, and we'll take it from there.
Sure, Joe. The Economic Democracy Act is a comprehensive national body of legislation that would enable every person, starting with every citizen, to have equal access to productive capital through access to asset-backed money and insured capital credit. And what that means is that it recognizes that the present system erects barriers to most people being able to acquire a viable stake of capital ownership. And why is this important? Well, we can see the pace with which artificial intelligence and automation is displacing human labor and the need for and jobs. So the question is, for each person within the economy, how will they be able to earn a living? And not just through charity or not just through government redistribution, but a private property-based way. And so the Economic Democracy Act, which contains some monetary reforms and some tax system reforms is all about how each person can get access to the common good, meaning that network of institutions, including things like the Federal Reserve, the money system, the tax system, so that they can develop to their fullest potential. And so it very much ties in with the concepts and principles of social justice as defined by Pius XI and economic justice as defined by Lewis Kelso and Mortimer Adler. So it's private property, free markets, limited government, but the missing element, and this is what the EDA is going to be established, is to make sure that every person from the day they're born to the day they die will be connected to the annual stream of financing that is directed at purchasing new capital, forming new capital to produce goods and services. And that's where people should get their incomes from, their own private property ownership of capital.
Yeah, which segues directly into, you know, the basis of the whole thing. See, Don mentioned the tax and monetary reforms, but as has been known throughout history, no law is ever going to be effective unless people accept it. For instance, you know, the most disobeyed law in American history until Prohibition was the Fugitive Slave Act. Why? Nobody went along with it in the North. They thought it was execrable. Is that a word? Anyway, the thing you have, you know, and what CESJ's efforts are directed to and what the whole of the Act of Social Justice is directed to is first primarily reform of persons. This is why they keep talking about, oh, well, if you're personally virtuous, everything will be all right. Well, sort of. Yes, you do have to be personally virtuous, but in order to be socially virtuous, you have to orient yourself in the right way. You can't just think of yourself, because as Aristotle pointed out, man is by nature a political animal. We find our full expression of ourselves as human persons, a favorite expression of John Paul II with his personalism, as members of society, the polis, you know, the political thought, not what we think of today as politics. Probably stay away from that as much as you can. But we are political animals finding our fullest human development as members of groups. And social justice, and economic justice is a subset of social justice overall, is directed at reforming our institutions so that we as persons can find our fullest human expression and develop our fullest human potential within a just social order. Social justice is directed at society. Individual justice is directed at the human individual human person.
What is Dawn Brohan and Michael Graney joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe? We're talking about the Economic Democracy Act. So what is the role of the central banks in all this? Because obviously, you know, in America, we look at the Fed, which doesn't have a wonderful reputation, as we know. And a lot of people intuitively know that the central bank has a lot of power. Some people think an inordinate amount of power. But you need a powerful bank. So where's the balance? I'll start with you, Dawn, to talk about what the role of the central bank is in all of this.
Well, it goes back to what is money and what is the role of money. And if we look at money as something we just want to accumulate for the sake of accumulating money, that is one approach. Or it can be used as a way for those who have it already to be able to acquire more and to make more money. What we see, though, is that money is a social tool. It's a way of measuring value in how we exchange what we produce with what other people produce. And it gives us a measurement so that we can determine that our exchanges are fair to each party. Now, the role of the central bank, and Mike he's an expert in this area, is really to regulate money so you know that there's a stable value, that it's legitimate money and not counterfeit. And so that's important, but also in terms of economic personalism, where we're looking at each human person and how that person is able to exercise his or her full rights to have dignity and the ability to grow and develop fully. that's going to require access to power. And power in the economic sphere doesn't come from having a job, because you are essentially at the beck and call of an employer or the government if you work for a government agency. But your means of producing is dependent on someone else. What we see, and this was recognized by the America's founders, I mean, in some ways, in a very bad way, and that was their understanding of property, which is the right to the fruits of and the right to control what you own. So how does this tie into what is money? If we see that future growth and production does not have to be limited to those, to money that has evolved from the past production and accumulation, but can be tied to the way businesses operate, profitable businesses, when they need to grow, they're able to get loans to purchase whatever assets they need with the reasonable projection that they're going to produce enough in the future, a stream of income, stream of revenue, that they can use that future stream to pay off the loan they got to acquire capital. So in this way, you are not, and no one should be bound by the fact that they have nothing today. It's a question of, is there an investment? And this is real investment, not Wall Street speculation and trading of existing stocks, but real investment to create saleable goods and services. If you know that that is fairly certain because you got customers with contracts, you got a good management team, you got a good workforce, that would say to a lender that, okay, if I make a loan for this purpose, it is highly likely that it will get repaid because there's a track record, et cetera. And if there isn't, well, there's this thing called collateral, which if the loan does not get repaid, the lender can say, okay, I'm going to take something from you to make me as whole as I can. And that is another barrier to universal access to ownership. And that is, if you don't have assets that a lender can take, if the loan goes bad, you're not going to get a loan. So under the just third way, and this is really the ideas of Lewis Kelso, and he's a figure that really people, policymakers, politicians really need to understand his thinking in terms of economics and ownership. So he, being a corporate finance lawyer, knew that there are ways to get, if you could get capital credit to purchase things that would pay for themselves, you can turn anyone into an owner. And he started with employee stock ownership plans, which enabled 100% of the workers in a company to purchase it from the, you know, the owners who wanted to sell and pay it back with corporate profits. So what the Economic Democracy Act does is it takes that same logic and it applies it to how can every person from the day they're born to the day they die have equal access to new money and capital credit specifically, not just credit to buy a car, buy a TV set, but credit that will only be used for feasible projects. And in this case, it will be your ownership will be represented by the shares that you buy from the companies that need your money or need investment in order to get the capital. So
Dawn, let me stop here for a second. Joe, I hope you don't mind. A question just popped in my head. Michael, I want to throw this over to you. I can hear somebody in the audience saying, break it down for me. What does it mean for the average guy? What's different between what Dawn just described and me going into the market and buying a share of Microsoft or buying a share of, heaven forbid, Anheuser-Busch, which is going down recently?
Hey, yeah, but that's a bargain now, though.
No, I don't think so. But well, that's a conversation for another day. What does it mean for, like, how does it look, Michael? How does this look? Get illustrate it. For the average guy out there, for the two average Joes that you're talking to right now.
Okay. For the way it operates now, where the stock market is basically a gambling casino, is if you've got a pile of money that you could use the old joke, how do you make a small fortune on Wall Street? Start with a large one. You go in there and you take your existing wealth and you put it at risk and try to pick something that's going to go up in value so that you can gamble and win. Okay. The average person does not have that kind of money to waste. nobody, frankly, nobody does, because there's a purpose for money, which is to spend. As Aristotle pointed out, the use of money is it's consumed by its use, by spending it. That's what money's for. Now, most people don't have it to spend on something stupid like that, even if they do. So what Kelso did was say, you know, for centuries, the rich have been getting rich because what they've done is they've had an idea. They don't have the wealth right now. What they have is an idea that can generate wealth. Commercial banks and central banks to back up the commercial banks were invented to take these ideas and what we call future savings, Kelso's term, and turn them into money now. Obviously, the wealth does not exist in the hands of the borrower yet, but the bank says, we are so certain that you're going to be able to do this, that we're going to put our names at risk. We're going to issue you these banknotes that have our name on them. We're going to stand behind them because you're standing behind what we're saying. You can use these banknotes or the demand deposits, you know, checking account, to purchase what you need to put this into operation. And you'll start generating income. You'll use part of the income to pay us back, and you'll use the rest of it to get rich or for your consumption needs. Kelso said, the rich have been doing that. Why can't the rest of us? And what his system did was figure out a way that all of us can use the system that the rich have been using for centuries, only now it can operate to the benefit of everyone. Well, what was it that made the rich able to do this? Well, it was called creditworthiness. What made them creditworthy? Collateral. So what Kelso said was, well, instead, what is collateral? Well, it's basically insurance for a loan. Anybody can buy an insurance policy if the loan is good enough. The insurance premium will be low enough. And every loan in existence has what they call a risk premium anyway. It's always risky to make a loan because, I mean, give the guy the money, he walks out and he's knocked over by the mob or he's struck by lightning or something. You're not absolutely certain any loan is ever going to be paid back, not even one to the government. You didn't hear that. So what Kelso said was, why not use capital credit insurance and, of course, reinsurance to insure bad insurance so that when a bank creates money, even if the loan goes bad, it can get the money back and then cancel it so that there's no inflation. That's basically Kelso's plan in a nutshell. Now, you ask, what is the central bank doing this? Well, if every single commercial bank was creating money on its own, every dollar would have a different value simply because every bank has a different credit rating. And I mean, that's just the way it is. I mean, a single bank's dollars would all be the same for that bank, but not between bank A and bank B. So what a central bank does, and this was it was a brilliant idea back in the late 17th century, when the merchant adventurers of London said, why can't we tie all our mercantile, the British word for a commercial bank is mercantile bank. Why can't we tie our mercantile banks together in one central bank so that all our pound notes are exactly the same whoever issues them? Because we are all tied in to our bank. A central bank is basically a commercial bank for commercial banks. Government got into it because of a bribe we won't get into. But if everything's working properly, a central bank will tie all its member commercial banks together so that the currency is the uniform, stable, asset-backed, and what they call elastic. It expands and contracts with the needs of the economy so that you avoid both inflation and deflation. You don't need all this inflation. You don't need inflation at all, period. At least the artificially induced demand pull inflation. Mm-hmm. The cost push and all that other stuff is a different matter.
Thank you for that, Michael. Dawn Brohorn, Michael Graney joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe, the Economic Democracy Act. Joe Rasinello.
Now, as you both know, I am a jaded corporate drone for the last 25 years, and I want to throw this at
you. The hell of a way of putting it, Joe.
So I want to just throw this at you, my experience, real life experience. What's in it for me? That's what rich people always say. What's in it for me? ultimately, does the establishment, this cuts across all political lines, this cuts across money, people who have money and power, they're not in the business of giving it away. They want to keep it. What's in it for me? Why would they want to do that? We know how banks operate. They operate, sadly, on principles of usury. It's simply the case. Compound interest is usury. Period. End of story. And it cripples people. And I'm going to direct this to Dawn. Why, if I am, I'm not picking on him, I don't know him, but I'm going to use his name, Jamie Dimon. He is rich. He runs JP Morgan. He may even be listening to us because he probably lives in Fairfield County, Connecticut. If he heard this approach, why would he do it? What's in it for Jamie?
Okay, that's a great question. I would say there are political reasons he should do it and economic reasons he should do it. The political reasons would start with the fact that there are many, many more have-nots than there are haves. And that number that is that ratio is getting worse. So at a certain point, when enough have-nots get just sick and tired, they will look for targets. And many times the most powerful people are able to escape for a time being, but you will have more political pressure to redistribute, as even this notion of universal basic income is going to require that the wealthy take their earnings from their capital and basically pay everyone out $1,000 a month, something like that. So politically, it's, you know, to avoid being strung up from a light pole, you know, that, to put it bluntly, and maybe we haven't seen that too much in this country, but in other parts of the world, Latin America and Africa and other very poor areas, you see that the coups that take place are quite bloody. So that's one thing. Now, what is the economic reason that a wealthy person should want to make capital ownership accessible to everyone? Well, you see that they are depending on their productive power, their capital, being able to produce and be purchased, the goods and services. They need customers with money. It's like an ecosystem. If you suddenly wipe out, you know, one part of the ecosystem, you'll, the rich, for example, will find, okay, their company produced so much this year, but they didn't have customers. So eventually it will come back. You have to have this balance. And the more that we try and correct this imbalance with, well, we'll just create more jobs. Well, what that's saying is whether or not you need more human labor, you're going to force an employer to have to hire more people or pay whoever you have a higher amount of wages and salaries, even though it may not be their inputs that are actually responsible for the increased production. And that's another hurdle that most economists have is what they understand to be the productive factors. So that's another discussion in and of itself. But I would say that it's going to, if you want to address the problems of poverty and racism, which is just in many ways, it's a response to from people who feel threatened, who feel that something is being taken away from them by another group, and war, largely they get started for economic reasons, even though they may bring in the cloak of religion or others, or other aspects. But also now we're dealing with, and I think, I hope that people are realizing that all this talk about what's happening to the climate, there's something real there. And I think we're starting to see this and the implications all over the planet. And to deal with that in a way that is not going to entail having this overlord that controls us and what we do, you need a system that understands the idea of sustainability and can finance it. So a lot of this is what kind of new capital tools are we going to introduce that don't waste resources, that don't cause pollution, that don't cause this damage to the environment. And a lot of times the designs are out there, they just, you know, no one has the money to finance them. So this is a reason why the super wealthy You know, unless they're so foolish to think that they can go and create their own private islands, which will produce everything that they need on that little island, if they understand we are all connected and we better start thinking about not only ourselves, but each other. That's the reason, I think.
Look, I'm going to hand the dawn over to Joe Racinello because after the break, because we're going to go to a break in about 3 minutes. But I don't want to start one of our keep going for the first second. I just want to go off script for a second. Michael, is one of the problems in America, see, because the way Joe and I look at it is this way. On the one side, you have those, let's say, that believe that it's only labor. The only thing that produces wealth is labor. They buy into radical ideologies like communism. On the other side, you have what Joe and I describe as human beings, which that's what labor is. You're talking about the labor of a human being treated as simply, and I mean simply, not exaggerating there, an entry on the balance sheet. And does not seem to be, in our view, and that's why I'm asking you, Michael, in the next 2 minutes, am I right in describing it that way? Okay. And do both sides need to make an adjustment?
They not only have to make an adjustment, they have to make a whole entire sea change. Because one, labor is not the only input to production, because don't you have any raw materials? Don't you have anything else? I mean, and of course, does nature produce anything without any labor input? This is the trouble an economist called David Ricardo got into when he said that land both is and is not productive. Okay, we'll go with that. You call that your detour. Now, is capital productive? Well, some people say that, well, we have human capital. I thought, please, human capital means that you just bought somebody on the auction block as a slave. Capital is the non-human factor of production. Once you join either, capital is productive in only one of two ways. Either a human being works with it to produce something, or a human being owns it to produce something. Both are equally valid, and both are essential if you're going to get something out of the productive process. As Jean-Baptiste Say pointed out 200 years ago, you know, the rich have something to sell. Why aren't they selling it? Because the poor aren't producing anything to buy it with. We do not buy and sell things for money. We buy and sell things with what we produce. If you're not able to produce, you can't buy and sell. Absent theft or charity, you must produce in order to be able to consume. You cannot consume that which has not been produced. Amazing, isn't it?
Well, you can't produce something that nobody is going to be able to buy. Because it seems to me that and we're going to take a break right now, but it seems to me that what you guys are describing is a system. Now, the capitalist, and I'm not bashing capitalism, but the capitalists are saying, well, we have a system too. But it doesn't seem to be, it's always forces that are butting heads with one another, rather than looking at more of a, and again, this is a word that people don't like to use, more of a cooperative system, all right, where the enterprise, if you want to look at the enterprise on a macro level, is benefiting the common good. That's not communism. That means that if I go into the market in any capacity, I could build my life. I could do the things I need to for my family and put food on the table and build my life. That means I'm entering into the system and I'm benefiting from the system, and my efforts are respected, is where I'm going, by the system.
And that's exactly what John Paul II was saying with personalism. A person is both an actor, this is his book, The Acting Person, and acted upon. The socialists say, no, you're just an actor. You do everything for everyone else. The capitalists say, no, I'm just acted upon because everything's for me. It has to be both.
That's got that paradigm. There needs to be a major paradigm shift there. Dawn Brohan, Michael Graney joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe. We're talking about the Economic Democracy Act and I guess a couple of other things here on the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial. Stick around another half hour with Dawn and Michael. We'll be right back.
Catholic radio works, and now we have it here in Connecticut and New York. It's been seen around the country that there's no better tool for evangelization. Where there's Catholic radio, the folks who listen deepen their faith, families are strengthened, parishes and communities flourish. So, let people know you're listening to Veritas, tell your friends to tune in, and let's make an impact here for Jesus and His Church. This is Steve Lee for Veritas Catholic Network.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Frontline with Joe and Joe. Joe Pasillo, Joe Racinello. We are way in the breach with friends of our show, Dawn Brohorn, Michael Graney. We're discussing the Economic Democracy Act. Joe Racinello.
Let's talk about practical application. Your ideas are starting to get out there. You recently participated in a conference in Bridgeport, Connecticut. There was one in Cleveland. There's an upcoming one in St. Louis. How are your ideas being received, Dawn?
Well, those conferences, I would say the one in Bridgeport was dealing with these concepts and how they could be applied at the community level. It would bring in all the features of equal citizen access to ownership through equal access to the money and credit needed and the role of the regional Federal Reserves and the commercial banks. But this was a specific application that was put into law in Missouri, and that was to create the Citizens Land Development Cooperative, which is just a land and infrastructure development corporation that would be professionally managed. It would have shareholders, and the shareholders are each of the members of the community. And this includes children in terms of their economic participation. They would also, and these mainly the adults, would have also a vote. So everyone has a single share in this. They don't pay for this. They don't pay for their shares. It comes with the establishment of the CLDC. And what that does is it would initially take over for free all government-owned land. So that could be local, state, or federal, depending on which government level is willing to give land that maybe is not being used at all. And transfer that for free to this citizen-owned corporation or cooperative. Once you get that land, then there's a question of how are you going to pay for all the improvements that will be made. For example, St. Louis and Bridgeport, they're a mess. Their roads are terrible. Their sewer system is broken down. I mean, it is really not an attractive place for businesses to locate. So the question is, where would you get the money to put in the infrastructure, to mitigate brownfields, and make it a place where businesses would say, yes, we want to move there. So that is where, if you try and go to the government and ask for money, or you ask for investors to come in, well, you can see they're not really jumping in fast. Although now there is some movement by developers to take over land. And what usually happens is whoever lives there is going to get pushed out because of rising land values. But in this case, through the commercial banks, who would have to vet any proposal in terms of improvements on the land, they would go to the regional Federal Reserve to have money created for the purpose of purchasing whatever is needed to improve the land. And then the question of where the profits are going to come from to repay the loan is where you would have to work out arrangements for businesses to locate on the land, may have incentives. And then they would be paying leasing fees to the CLDC. So any use of land, and that could eventually include even the land that houses are built on, where the land, natural resources, infrastructure are owned by the CLDC, which is owned by the citizens. So this becomes a way, this first law beyond the employee stock ownership plan is really looking towards the goal of the Economic Democracy Act, and that is equal access to capital ownership through equal access to asset-backed money and insured capital credit.
Michael Graney, it sounds a lot like a revenue bond, or the concept behind a revenue bond, where let's say there's a project, you need the money for the project. Well, how are you going to guarantee the loan gets repaid? Like the Lincoln Tunnel, just use an example, was built with a revenue bond. The tunnel doesn't exist. We need the money. How are you going to pay it back? We're going to charge a toll. And the people that go back and forth. Am I wrong in describing it that way? Or how does it differ than how does what Dawn just described, as far as you're saying that you're going to get businesses and attract businesses to come and establish businesses on that land? And I'm assuming that the revenues that are generated there, there's going to be, dare I say, some sort of a tax, or of some sort. And maybe I'm using the wrong word. And then that's gonna go to repay the loan. Where am I off, if I am at all, Michael?
And who owns? Now, who owns the Lincoln Tunnel?
Well, the Port Authority. Yeah.
But that's not the citizens. I mean, the citizens don't own the Lincoln Tunnel. They don't own the Golden Gate Bridge out in California. They don't own, I mean, the thing is.
I just meant conceptually, you want to attract businesses, you get them there, they start doing business, they produce something, they pay back the loan.
Yes. In other words, they're not going to get the use of the land for free, even though some municipalities like, just went out of my head, the place in Connecticut that screwed up.
Bridgeport.
No, it wasn't Bridgeport. New London. Yeah, that whole horrible thing there where they just said, we're going to give you the land and everything else. And then they screwed them. It's now a garbage dump, I understand. But
so is New Jersey, Michael. But
I wasn't going to say anything.
Cape May. How about that?
That's nice.
Depends on which exit. Okay. But the difference is that the citizens own the CLDC, which owns the land and the infrastructure. Now, yes, to use the land and the infrastructure, you're going to have not a tax, but a user fee. See, taxes go to government. User fees, they might even be lower because you don't have to worry about the graft and corruption. You know.
So as a citizen, I own the land. Basically, you're going to use the land. You're going to pay a fee. We're going to use that fee to repay and...
Yeah.
Yes.
Actually, no, I'm getting a fee because I am an owner of the land.
Yes.
So that's going towards my wealth accumulation.
Right.
Exactly. Okay. Because think about this. Once the loan is repaid, and if there continues to be this stream of income generated by businesses or whoever paying the leasing fee for use of land, that becomes income to you, the shareholder. So that is not only the power of having a voice in planning, but also having a share of all income, all profits that are generated. So that's a big difference.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. Michael Graney, Dawn Brohorn, joining us here at the front line with Joe and Joe. Joe Racinello.
I also, through conversations with Michael, he told me that Nigeria has expressed some interest, which I find to be interesting because I could remember years ago, I believe someone may even won the Nobel Prize. I know the two of you will one day, and Joe and I were going to go to Norway. I will bring the beer. Joe will bring the popcorn. It will be quite a day.
But that beer will not be Bud Light. Go ahead.
Good.
But Michael did mention that Nigeria expressed some interest, and I do remember like micro loans whereby people said women, if you fund them, they'll start local businesses because the women are taking care of the children, and that got some traction. I can remember that a while ago. But now you have an African nation that's expressing interest in this. Tell us about that, Michael. I think that's very interesting. Yeah.
Well, first a clarification. It's not Nigeria per se. It's the Biafran independence movement in Nigeria.
Okay, fair enough.
So, and according to them, and I have every reason to believe it, the Asquith British government back in 1914 created Nigeria as a fake nation, squishing together three separate groups that didn't really belong together. And they said it was only going to last 100 years. So they are asking the British government to keep their promise, which expired in 2014, and say, we want to be a separate nation, Biafra land. They even have their own flag and everything else. And what they've done is say, we also want to make certain, first, to get away from that whole bad reputation of Nigeria right now. I mean, if you want to say, oh, it's a Nigerian scam. They say, we want to form a good personalist, solidly based natural law economy that will be consistent with the social teachings of the main religions. Most of them are Christian that we've been dealing with. And this, if done the right way, Biafra could become a model nation for Africa. I mean, yeah, you've got some halfway decent economies in Africa, but none of them are really anything you'd want to use as a model. I mean, South Africa is probably the best, and it's got so many problems with it that you don't want to use it as a model. The North African nations, at this point, you can pretty much take them or leave them. And the rest is what the Chinese are trying to take over. So what we really need at this point is an African nation that could do this, take it and run with it. And it's not the only place. For instance, Personally, I would like to see it happen in Puerto Rico. Not to compete with the New York Port Authority, but a while back, Puerto Rico put in their own Port Authority, spent millions on it, and basically did nothing because there's such weird regulations governing the territory of Puerto Rico that they can't get the business they should have had. And because take a look at the map, Puerto Rico is perfectly positioned to take advantage of the main trade routes of the entire world. They got the Panama Canal right behind them. They've got direct access to North and South America, almost equidistant from both of them, and about the same distance to Africa and to Europe. They could be a transshipment point for the entire world. This is why Puerto Rico was so hotly contested for centuries. And now it's just basically an economic backwater. Mm. Its potential is going nowhere, and it could be it could beat out New York City in wealth if it was used properly. Now, also, and just in the news recently, the island of Rhodes. I mean, you had, devastated by fires. It needs to be rebuilt. What we're talking about could rebuild it quickly. And what about Ukraine? After finally kicked Putin out, they're going to have to rebuild. That's going to be one heck of a job. Right now they're saying, oh, there's not enough money in the world to rebuild Ukraine. You don't need to have the money existing. You can make it so that it finances itself with what we're talking about.
Don Brojón, let me throw this over to you. Everything that you guys are talking about seems to make all the sense in the world. So the obvious question is, who would be opposed to it? I suppose there's a lot of people who would be opposed to this, particularly politicians who let's be clear. And again, I don't think this is a genius statement on my part, okay? People who are powerful do not want to give up power. People who are wealthy do not want to see others do well. In general, there are very good people out there who are wealthy. There are very good people out there who are powerful. In general, they don't want to give anything up. So it strikes me that you, Dawn, and Michael, and anyone who would like to see this implemented and applied in practice, that's a major hurdle, is to get over people's greed for both power and money and not wanting to share either of those two things. Talk about that a little bit, Dawn, please.
Well, I think you're absolutely right that people who have power are not going to just give it up. And people who have don't want to have anything taken away from them. And I'd say our idea is one that does not require any taking from the haves to give to the have-nots. It is allowing opportunity to be truly equally accessible. I would say the biggest problem beyond greed is that we're today operating in a paradigm which keeps us in conflict constantly, whether it's people who work versus those who own capital and companies. But it's a paradigm shift that has to take place. And that is going to start in where the ideas we teach and, how they're taught. And if you look at academia, almost universally, they're either going to come from the capitalist school, which is basically the elite have the right to own because they're the smarter ones or, more successful business. And then you have the socialists who think that it's really, we need government to make sure everyone is going to be able to, live, stay alive. And you, under both systems, you end up with dependence. So where does that start? And really, we got to look at the universities because they are influencing politicians, they're influencing legislation. They're shaping the way we think about the possibilities of the future. And what we would like is just, your platform is exactly what we want, is more access for these ideas to be heard by more people and discussed and debated. And I think we can show enough proof that this works. The financing method certainly works. The benefit to corporate culture also measurably has been proven, that where you have a true ownership culture versus, this is my job, I'm not going to do anything more than what you say, and I don't care if, someone's stealing from the company, what is it, I just work here. The difference in attitudes are measurably significant when you have people who have an ownership stake in something. So I think that really looking, you know, there are different ways to look at the paradigms that exist. We can lump all existing schools of thought, everything that's being taught in terms of the economic framework, as wage welfare. Really, the way that most people earn a living is through their job, which means they depend on wages and salaries being able to keep them able to buy the things that they want. And if they don't have a high enough wage, they're going to use power through the unions to get it. So that is, you know, there are many different things. If you want private property, if you want free markets, and you want limited government, you're going to have to rethink your paradigm. So we want more opportunities to present these ideas.
I want to hand it over to Joe Racinello. But I will say this: back in another life, when I was not such a good person, I used to be, and not that I'm a good person now, but I used to be a stockbroker, and we had a source for some leads, you know, a cold calling stockbroker. It was amazing. One time I was calling these leads, and everybody I was calling seemed to be from the Northern Midwest, and they were all old and they were retired. And they said they had like a couple $1 million net worth in retirement. And I said, well, what did you do for a living? And they all worked. I think they had all recently retired from Procter & Gamble, or one of the big consumer product companies, that over the course of 30 years, these people accumulated that stake in the success of the corporation, of the enterprise that you're talking about, Dawn and Michael. And guess what? They retired not with just a pension or looking forward to Social Security, with actual wealth, shares in the corporation that they spent 30 years working for. And I thought it was amazing. And what you guys are talking about here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe, it strikes me that that's similar, not the same, of course, but similar to the paradigm shift that you're talking about. Those people had a vested interest in the success of the corporation. They weren't just wage slaves, okay, or wage welfare. If you say to a normal wage slave that your company stock just went up, they say, who cares? It doesn't benefit me. Give that person 10 shares or 50 shares a year over the course of time, or 100 shares a year over the course of time as part of their compensation. You're damn right they're going to worry about whether the stock goes up or not. Anyway, that was my little rant, Joe Racinello.
Oh, you said it better than I could, Joe. That's great.
Well, you know, there's an organization out in Berkeley, California, the National Center for Employee Ownership. And according to their studies over many years, they have found that companies that are, you know, worker-owned, have participatory management and profit sharing, outperform otherwise comparable companies by 150%.
I believe it. And I want to hand it over to Joe. I know I keep saying that, but I believe you want to why.
No,
because what happens is, and again, I know this may seem a bit not simplistic, but just simple, is that when you don't have that type of arrangement, the owner of the means of production, the owner of the enterprise, is only worried about his own interests. And labor is only worried about its own interests. And again, it goes from my mind, it all goes back to the enterprise. Why isn't everybody worried about the success of the enterprise for the benefit of all? The owner's still going to make the lion's share of the money. The owner's still going to get rich. Okay.
Yeah. This is what Walter Reuther was talking about when he testified before the Joint Economic Session of Congress back in 1967. He said, well, you know who Walter Reuther was? He was head of the UAW. They used to call him a socialist. Then he heard about Kelso, and he said, "Why? This is it. We don't need inflation. We don't need we don't need to take our fixed wage and benefit packages and keep increasing that increased costs. That makes the American automobile industry uncompetitive with Japan, with Germany, with all these others who are driving. They're selling cheap cars. We're losing out and losing jobs." My union is going down the tubes because of this. He said,
right.
Why not take profit sharing? Have share ownership. This gives people the right to profits, and this will keep costs down, increase the market, and the American industry will remain competitive. And they didn't do it. And what has happened?
Nope, exactly right. Joe Racinello, again, I apologize. I meant to hand it over to you for about five minutes ago.
A great conversation.
Because this is, and listen, you guys mentioned the success of our program. As our program, you will always be on our show, because when we are reaching 1 million, 2 million, 5 million people out there, okay, we will get these ideas out, because these are important ideas. And a lot of these, what you guys are discussing, are not being discussed out there. Joe.
Before the show, Dawn and I were chatting, and I thought this was very impressive, and people should as well. She mentioned that a gentleman who was involved with Ben Bernanke when he was the chairman of the Federal Reserve has taken some interest in this program. Dawn, tell us about that, because I think that shows that this is a credible approach to possibly changing things. Everyone talks about change. Well, here's an idea. How about we change? Who is that gentleman, Dawn?
Right. Well, this was, I think, maybe a year or two ago, we heard about Tom Honig, who was president of the Kansas City Federal Reserve for, I think it was almost 20 years. It was quite a long time. And he then switched over to a high level position in the FDIC. That's what insures banks. And it turns out that Tom, he has a doctorate, and he's a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. It turns out that while he was on the Federal Open Market Committee of the Federal Reserve, and that's really the power center, that and the chairmanship of the Federal Reserve, while he was there, he was the only governor to oppose what's called quantitative easing. And quantitative easing is just the pumping of more dollars, unbacked dollars, into the economy in order to stimulate demand and thereby stimulate more production. So he could see what was going to happen with that. And he repeatedly voted no against these increases. I'm trying to remember how we came across him personally, but someone in our network had contacted him, you know, had learned about him and contacted him. And we had a few conversations with Tom Honig, you know, a very busy guy still, even though he's retired. And he was listening very carefully to what we were saying and started reading our materials. And between that period and today, we hadn't heard too much from him. And it turns out one reason may be that there is a book written about, you know, how the Federal Reserve broke the American economy. And it's really centered around him, this story of this individual. So he is very free market, very private property oriented, but also very concerned about the wealth concentration that's getting worse. And he attributes that largely to the policies of the Federal Reserve. And we would agree with him because it's essentially getting money for capital to those who already have, not to every person as a fundamental human right. So we recently got in touch with him and we'll be continuing this conversation. The new thing being, and I think Joe Racinello had raised this earlier, is that there's a specific project going on in Missouri called the Heart of America Project. It's largely the brainchild of Gene Gordon, who is the founder and executive director of Descendants of American Slaves for Economic and Social Justice. And his group is largely taking the principles, the Just Third Way principles and financing approaches of CESJ. So he's on our board, and he was able to get a state senator to introduce and get passed and signed into law by a Republican governor, she's Democrat, legislation that would establish the world's first citizen-owned, citizens land development cooperative. And this, I won't go into the details right now, but it's basically a land infrastructure, natural resources development company whose shareholders are each person who lives within a particular community. And it could even extend to a state, but every person, that includes every child and every adult, would be shareholders with an equal share, which would receive dividends and would have a vote in terms of how representatives to this would be elected and on certain policies. But through Gene's efforts, he was able to get this law passed. It was something that CESJ had actually developed for East St. Louis across the river. But now we had someone who was able to get it actually passed. And that was, it's going to involve the use of the Federal Reserve in St. Louis in terms of, okay, it's supposed to get transferred free of charge from government, any government-owned land. But then you sit, you know, in a place like St. Louis or Bridgeport or East St. Louis, that land is a mess. No one wants to locate on it. So you're going to need money in order to develop the land. Where will that come from? So that is a demonstration of financing that we're proposing for the Economic Development Act. So that becomes a focus for us in terms of demonstrating this paradigm, showing how this would work in terms of true community development, empowerment of every citizen in that community, and also the proper role of commercial banks, insurance, and the regional Federal Reserves that were created to do exactly what we're saying.
Michael, going to throw it over to you for the last minute and a half or so to piggyback on that and any final thoughts.
Well, I don't have much to say.
Michael, you're never tongue-tied, Michael, so that you get the final word.
I can't add too much to what Dawn said, because basically what she did was outline the whole program. The whole thing is the problem with much of society today, and I'm realizing I'm being cosmic right now, is people have forgotten what it's all about. It's all about the human person. If you're not focused on the human person, and I mean each and every single human person, we don't have to worry about, the quality, the low quality people over here. And remember, I always go back to this, what Aristotle said, we are by nature political animals. We're not supposed to be hermits off in the desert someplace. We're also not supposed to be amorphous members of a collective. We are individuals who find our fullest human potential within a social setting. And as Pope St. John Paul II pointed out, we are all.
I think we lost Michael. Michael had a technical glitch there. Dawn, where can people buy your book, The Greater Reset? Klaus Schwab talked about The Great Reset. You guys have a book, The Greater Reset. Where can folks buy that book?
Yes, I would go to tanbooks.com. They sometimes have excellent sales on that book, and that's the time to buy many copies. And in fact, one of our CSJ members bought about 40 copies, contributed to his spiritual center, to the bookstore there, to do whatever they want to. So that's a way of getting the word out. So we would highly recommend people get The Greater Reset through Tan Books.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
Mike's you're back, Michael, but it's too late. Too late.
You'll be back, Michael. You'll be back.
Thank you all. Thank you both, Dawn Brohaw and Michael Graney, for joining us here at the Frontline with Joe and Joe. And we would encourage anyone to check out more of the organization that they founded, which is the CESJ, which is the Center for Economic and Social Justice. Thank you all out there for joining us at the Veritas Catholic Radio Network, 1350 on your AM dial, 103.9 on your FM dial, spreading the truth of the Catholic faith to the New York City metropolitan area. Download the app, share it with your friends. And if you like what Joe and I do, please, wherever you see us on social media, like, subscribe, share, do all that fun stuff. And remember, until the next time, that our conversation is your conversation. And that conversation is going on everywhere. We'll talk to you soon.